Kia ora and welcome to Sobriety Chat. I am your host, Lotta Dan. I am the community manager and content creator here at livingsober.org.nz, otherwise known as Mrs. D in recovery circles. And I'm joined today by Kate Smith, who is down country from me in Arrowtown. She is a ex-mad woman, which relates to mad men, so advertising circles. She is a mountaineer. She is a wife. She is a pet owner and lover. And she is sober. Welcome, Kate.
Hi, Lotta. Really good to be here.
Oh, thanks for coming on. So tell me, how's your day been? What have you been doing? It's midday now. What have you been doing to get your bum on the chair talking to me now?
My day's been really good. I've had a very busy week with work, so I've been having to get up early and work, but today I didn't have to do that. So I got up with my husband. We did Wordle together. He went off to work. I did my morning meditation. I've just been off and had coffee with someone about a trust I'm involved with. Came home, had my breakfast, and here I am with you.
What a great morning, and what a vivid Wordle it was today.
Wasn't it?
We should say that because we're not giving anything away, because this will be published weeks away. But today's Wordle word was vivid. Now, tell me, Kate, how many days is it now that you've been sober?
Well, the way I count my days is number of days sober over number of days since I crossed the threshold into recovery. So I have not been sober every day since I found recovery. So I can't remember exactly, to be honest, but I think I'm on about a total of 480, and I've had two slips. So I'm 478 over 480. That's the way I like to count my days, because
I love it.
My view is your elapse does not wipe out your sober time. And that's a way of remembering that I made really good decisions on 478 days and not such great decisions on 2 days.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot at Living Sober, and we often refer to a string of pearls. And yeah, every sober day is like a pearl. And just because you dropped a couple doesn't mean you lose the string. So yeah, that's great. And how do you, I'm interested in how you, so you talk about the, when you entered recovery and then when you, since you last had a drink, what does entering in recovery mean? Describe to me what that means to you when you did that and you entered into recovery.
Well, for me, it meant I woke up, you know, on yet another day one, and I've had thousands, like literally thousands of day ones, waking up feeling, you know, that feeling of physically ill, remorseful, full of shame, confused, how the hell did this happen again? And I just knew that, this sounds melodramatic, but it really is what it felt like. It's like, if I cannot get on top of this, it is going to kill me. I had just such a strong feeling of that. And so what I did was I reached out to a therapist, and I had a really good conversation with her, and she basically said, you know, I can help you, but it's going to require some really deep work. And are you ready for that? And I said, yes, because I was desperate. So for me,
they
that's
call it, really, you know, the gift of desperation, isn't it? Because you're at that point where you just can't anymore.
Yeah. I thought that I'd felt that in the past, but this time it really was just that deep, like in the bone feeling of, this is going to kill me. If I don't manage to beat this thing, it will kill me. So yeah, I was desperate. I reached out to Lexi, who's my therapist, who I still talk to now, and you know, and started the, I hate the word journey, but yeah, I started the journey.
I know. It's so cliched, but it's so perfect.
Yeah, because, you know, because it is, right, isn't it?
That it is. Risk.
Yeah.
Sorry to cut you. I was just going to say, I love how you describe you know, that last morning, and the, I can't remember what all the emotions were you listed, but among them was confusion. And it is confusing. And I often say this to people, when you look at someone who's struggling with alcohol or addicted or whatever you want to call it, you can see it, you can see a little bit on the outside, but the worst stuff is what's happening in here. The worst stuff is that guilt and that shame and that confusion. Because for me, it was me at 9 a.m, adamant that I was not going to have a drink that day. And it was me at 3 p.m. going and buying that bottle of wine and then waking up the next morning. And it's confusing. It's awful, isn't it?
It really is. And it's, I mean, it really kind of hacks at the roots of your self-esteem. And, you know, I was completely unable to trust myself because I made, you know, hand on heart promises, promised my husband, promised myself, I'll never do it again. I'll never do it again. And then, as you say, like 4 o'clock rolls around and somehow I've convinced myself that it's a really good idea to have a drink.
And it's and you convince yourself, it's your own voice. Yeah.
And so for me, one of the really helpful things that Lexi taught me was this idea of, you know, your addict brain, that number one, you have an addict brain. And for me, actually understanding what that meant, like the neurochemical basis of addiction, was really important, and particularly at dissolving the sort of shame around it. But also that, you know, my addict, to start learning the ability to listen to when my addict brain starts getting active and when my addict brain starts talking and what it's trying to get me to do. So just that sort of awareness of that, like almost like two people, there's Kate, true Kate, and then there's addict Kate. And addict Kate is dangerous, and she will do whatever she can to nudge me closer to having a drink every day. Like every day she will do that.
Is she still? You still hear her every day?
I don't necessarily hear her every day, but I'm aware that she's there every day for sure. And all it will take, like any slight little chink of, you know, I'm feeling stressed. Like Friday is more of a dangerous day for me, because when it's a sunny Friday after, like I got drunk every Friday for literally decades. Every sunny Friday afternoon, addict Kate goes, it would be really nice to go to the pub and have a glass of wine today. Like she does that. I mean, she'll do it today. So you just have to go, yeah, I know that's what you think, but we all know that that is not what happened. It wouldn't be a glass of wine in the pub. We know where that would end. And sorry, but it's not happening.
Yeah, no.
So, you know, piss off.
And hopefully she will piss off and fade away. And I've certainly found the longer I've gone not drinking, I don't have that little voice trying to convince me anymore. I did have the other night, I was saying to someone, for the first time in many, many months, if not years, and it was a Friday, and I'd had a real shit of a day, and I just said out loud, and thankfully I said it out loud because it took some of the heat out of it, but I just said out loud, God, it's not as if I get to escape this afternoon or anything, meaning I wanted some relief and some escape. Acknowledged I couldn't do that, and I wouldn't call it a craving or my addict voice coming in, but it was just that, you know, life is hard, and the drug works, and sometimes we want that escape, don't we? And especially when we become addicted and we're so used to it, it just gets so entrenched into that habit. It is a hard one to kick. So well done you.
Well, yeah, and also I think, you know, what it's taken me a lot of time and work to recognize that a lot of my drinking was about numbing feelings. And to actually be able to put some space between the feeling and then that sense of I want to drink, to actually recognize that it's the feeling that's triggering the craving. You know, and some of those are feelings, I was so good at numbing them before I even consciously felt them, that to actually uncover all of that has actually been quite a process. And, you know, without Lexi's help, I wouldn't have been able to do that. Like I had my most recent lapse, I was completely bewildered by, like, where the hell did that come from? I'd been sober 9 months, something like that. And I was like, I wasn't even close to having a drink. And then I won't go into all the details, but basically there was a bit of a family emergency. My husband had to shoot off. I was left on my own. And literally by the time he was getting into the car, I knew that I was going to drink.
Wow.
And it happened, like, it came out of literally out of the blue. And when Lexi helped me unpack it, it was all to do with feelings that came up, very strong feelings that came up that I didn't recognize, which triggered this, I need a drink to be able to cope with this. That wasn't a conscious process at all. It's completely
amazing. And I mean, you've, like you said, that's been your go-to strategy or method of soothing that emotion for decades. So it makes sense. I mean, it's painful, I know. And, you know, my heart goes out to you for that, because I know those sorts of lapses can be really painful. But in a way, you're trying to look after yourself. But isn't it powerful that it happened so quick? And yeah, I just, the next day, just reliving all that shame and guilt is just crippling.
Well, and then going, you know, then you go through the negotiation of, you know, do I tell Lexi? Do I admit it to my recovery group? Do I tell Mike about it, my husband, because it's going to upset him? Nobody needs to know. Like, nothing happened. Nobody witnessed it. I can just, you know, I can just keep it quiet. And so, you know, it took me 24 hours before I finally texted Lexi and said, I drank yesterday, you know. And
right,
then after,
but you did it the next night, though. So you pulled, you, no, you no, just did no, that was, one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Well, look, good on you, because you didn't, you know, for people who aren't aware, a lapse is considered a brief, maybe a one-off or a brief period back to drinking, and a relapse is considered a more extended period of going back to the behaviour. And you didn't let the lapse turn into a relapse. And that means you're building your sober muscle. I mean, reaching out to your things that you have in place, whether it be Lexi, your recovery group, your husband, you know, that sort of stuff's huge, because we hide so much when we're in active addiction. And you're not hiding it anymore, Kate.
Well, no, exactly. And what, you know, what I've learned is that shame is like kryptonite. For me, like, if I am still in shame, and then the corollary of shame is secrecy, then I am in trouble. Like, the more I can drag things out into the light and talk about them, the stronger my sobriety is.
Oh, why do you think I do everything I do? It's basically selfish. I know everyone thinks, Lottie, you're so great, you're helping other people, and don't get me wrong, I love that too, but it keeps me well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I sort of, you know, came out kind of progressively, but the last sort of coming out was on LinkedIn, you know, going out to my professional network. And I'm, you know, I'm self-employed. I'm a strategist and a facilitator. I work with, you know, CEOs and boards and all the rest of it. So that was terrifying. Like, I was really, really frightened about doing that. And then when I thought, what does Addict Kate want you to do? And I was like, Addict Kate telling you that you're never going to work again, no one's going to trust you, all the rest of it. It was like, right, well, I have to do it then. And, it, you know, as you say, I was doing it for myself. Because,
and what was the response?
Well, you don't know that, you know, I'm sure there are some people who've gone, oh, shit, no, ooh, don't think we want to work with her anymore. But largely the response was incredibly positive.
Yeah, I mean, I doubt that there would have been. I'd be surprised. I mean, maybe there are the odd person that still judges. But actually, what I find is every time you tell someone, actually, I'm in recovery from addiction, or I'm sober now, I've been sober for 10 years, what you see in their eyes is admiration and respect.
And it's amazing how, like, I've had, in my professional network, I've had so many conversations now with people who've, you know, either talked about their own problem, or a family member or a friend or whatever. And, you know, you end up having these really authentic conversations with people that I would never have had normally.
Yeah, I think the ship is very, as I was saying to my husband, we're talking about the Titanic, right? The drinking culture, it's the Titanic. I think it's got a long way to go. But I think it started just doing this little nudge, this tiny little nudge, and it's happening from more people speaking up about it and being open about it. And eventually we will see, I'm convinced we'll see a shift away from the situation we live in now with this oversaturation and this huge amounts of harm that's caused by this drug. But I wanted to ask you a little bit about the advertising industry, because you said to me in an email that, you know, this has been your world. You've worked in advertising at top levels, high pressure, a lot of fun, I imagine, creativity. I mean, amazing, right? Amazing sector with amazing people. And yet you were doing quite a lot of drinking at that time. And the culture, I think, was pretty boozy. What can you sort of tell us about that world and alcohol and how that played out for you?
Well, I mean, the culture of advertising as a whole is just awash in booze. So I only really started drinking when I started working in advertising in London in the early 80s. So I went right through university. I think I got drunk once in my 3 years at university. It just wasn't part of my crowd, you know. But when I started working in advertising, wow, it was fun. It was, you know, we drank when we won pitches, we drank when we lost, we drank when we had a good meeting, when we had a bad meeting. You know, a few nights a week, people would say, oh, you know, come to the pub. We'd all go to the pub every Friday lunchtime. As it turned out, my boss was an alcoholic, which I only found out years later. And, you know, and I sort of became his drinking buddy. So there was a restaurant in Kensington called Maggie Jones at that time. And they used to serve wine in these big wicker-covered bottles. And there was a straw in it. And they'd bring this bottle. And you basically just, they would measure how much you drank by the straw. And it was covered in wicker. So unless you were counting your glasses, you didn't know how much you drank. So, you know, so that's where it sort of started. And it was a way of fitting in. Like, I was new to the industry, quite shy, not particularly confident socially. So, you know, it was a way of fitting in. It was all fun. And then every agency that I worked in had had pretty strong booze culture. But at Saatchi, I worked at Saatchi's in Wellington, you know, and we had a free bar. So you could go to the bar any night of the week and pretty much drink as much as you wanted. And every Friday night was a massive party. Like, the Saatchi bar was the place to be on Friday night.
And I think I might have actually been there, you know.
You probably did. Most people were at some point.
Well, I worked in the media in Wellington and it was equally as boozy.
Yeah. So, you know, for someone, by the time I arrived, so I got to New Zealand in 1995, I already had a pretty bad drinking problem by then. But, you know, the culture was like, it was like, you know, a leopard hiding in the jungle, like hiding in plain sight. You couldn't, it was perfect for someone with a drinking problem, because nobody really, well, that's not quite true, but, you know, it wasn't as if I was standing out like a sore thumb. I was maybe occasionally going, people would go, ooh, you know, you went a bit hard last night.
You hit
night.
It a bit hard last night, ha, 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 but yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, it was pretty normal, pretty accepted. It's the way, you know, right. Just the way that things rolled.
But it's also really isolating, because even if you, at that time, yes, you're partying and boozing and all the rest of it, you're starting to have that shame, those 3 a.m. wake-ups, that guilt, that kind of little voice that maybe is a little bit worried, yet your whole environment saying, hey, this is fine. So how do you marry that with what you're really feeling? And so you hide it and then you feel isolated and you feel the shame.
Well, yes. I mean, I didn't have any doubt by that. I knew I had a drinking problem before I even got to New Zealand, before I ever got to Saatchi's, because what I drank, you know, at work and in front of people was one thing, but I drank a lot more when I was at home. I lived on my own then. I drank a lot more when I was at home on my own, and nobody saw that. You know, when I've talked to various of my colleagues about this, you know, and they're like, wow, we had no idea. And I was like, yeah, like, you saw maybe, you know, if I drank a bottle at work, I would have gone home and drank two.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I was the same. Absolutely. I always knew that I'd go home and have more because I didn't feel full enough, or I was holding myself slightly back. So you said that you sort of grew up in a culture of secrets and shame, and I sort of did as well. I've got an English background and everything, was always keep it in the family and you'll be fine. A lot of sort of emotion suppression. And then you, like you say, hiding in plain sight. So now you've done this turnaround and you're like, this is me. I'm not, this addict Kate isn't going to win anymore. Here I am. What does this feel like, being so open, Kate? I mean, it's brave and amazing and wonderful, and thank you. But what does it actually feel like now?
Well, most of the time it feels like just a massive relief because until I did it, I didn't realize the extent to which I was holding people at arm's length. Like even people that I would count as my closest friends, even my family, like my sister, that I was actually holding them away because I was scared of what they would see if I let them in. So you don't, I didn't realize how isolated that made me feel. So there's the kind of relief, and then, just the sheer energy of keeping secrets. Like you don't realize until you stop doing it how freaking exhausting it is. Like it's just tiring. But I must admit, there are times when it makes me feel quite vulnerable. And, at times when, like last November when I had a lapse, Addict Kate gets on and she's going, "Oh, you're such a fraud. Like you're out there pretending that, you've got all the keys to the recovery and, you're talking it up." And, because I write on Medium and, I've got an Instagram thing which is Addicts Allowed, and it's like, and she got really busy with, the shame thing. Like, who the hell do you think you are? Like, you're just pretending. We know that this is bullshit. Like, you're not really that person. So at times like that, I feel quite vulnerable. But the longer I do it and the more conversations I have, like with this, with other people, like talking to Guyon about the work that he's doing, I do a recovery group every week. The more you get sort of like, I was thinking this morning, I thought it's the difference between identifying as someone who doesn't drink anymore, which is kind of, versus the person you were, versus I'm a person who's in recovery. I am now a sober person. My identity as a sober person is solid. I feel solid in my recovery. That doesn't mean that I am never going to drink again. I'm not sufficiently confident to be able to say that. I hope I never do, but Addict Kate is powerful. And I don't know what triggers there may still be out there that could completely trip me up the way exactly what happened to me in November.
You just tell that addict, Kate, there's no room for you anymore, sister. Thank you. Thank you for for trying to do your best for me, but I'm doing it a different way now.
Yeah, and I
I like,
mean,
sorry, you spoke.
have you come across No Bad Parts, the internal family
No.
system? Okay, well, there's a book by a guy called Richard Schwartz, and it's called No Bad Parts. And essentially, it is about looking at all the different parts of you, and he categorizes as firefighters and exiles, and I can't remember what the other categorizations.
No
But
bad parts.
looking at them all and understanding what is it that they're trying to do for you. So even when they're doing completely the wrong things, understand what is it they're actually trying to do. And so that's been, for me, that's been really helpful because I kind of no longer, I don't feel as if I'm kind of in this, I used to describe it as like it feels like being toe to toe with the devil. Like this just like, epic battle. I don't really feel like that anymore. I feel more now it's kind of like, yeah, Addict Kate, she's along for the ride now. Like I can't just dump her on the side of the road like a piece of baggage, but I don't actually
Right.
have to fight with
So
her
sorry
anymore.
about the finger.
No, that's fine. But for me, it's kind of, I have gone through that, but I'm kind of at the stage now of we have to live together. But you are not and never will again run my life. Even if I do have a lapse, you're never running my life again. That those days are gone.
Oh my God, Kate, I am so delighted you are sober and you have joined the cool sober gang. I often say on Living Sober, we are the cool ones, right? You feel like you're the loser, but actually we're the ones being countercultural. We're the ones being super rebellious, spurning this drug, which is everywhere, cheap as chips, available everywhere, heavily marketed. We're the ones that are swimming against the boozy tide. We are the cool ones. And I just might, it's like pull everyone into the gang because history will be on our side, truly. And the more that you live sober and go through stuff and build up those muscles and get into your grounded, authentic, because you're obviously amazing at what you do and you've had this booze in the way and now it's gone and you're being forced to kind of become your most authentic self, you're just gonna blossom. It's just wonderful. I'm so happy for you.
Thank you.
I wanted to
your books, Lotta, have I've read all of them and they've all been a huge help to me. So I thank you so much for all the work that you've done.
I get vulnerability from writing those as well. And I now talk about vulnerability hangovers. This might work for you. And it's a real thing where you might do something and then you do feel like maybe when you did the LinkedIn post the next day, you have a vulnerability hangover. And so you look after yourself like you would a friend or someone who was having a sensitive day, a bad day. And you do all, you just like, this is what I'm feeling. And so I often... I do, because I still have it. Maybe if I go on the TV and the interview goes bad or something, I'll have a vulnerability hangover the next day and I don't feel great. And I just take care of that.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask you before we go, in the advertising world, would it be fair to say that you'd perhaps done a bit of work on alcohol campaigns? What can you tell us about the kind of tactics that go on from the liquor industry to push out this drug and market it and sell it?
Well, I mean, it's funny actually, because when I look back on it now, I don't know if I feel ashamed exactly, but I wish that I had thought about what I was doing, if that makes sense. I feel a bit like that about my advertising career as a whole, actually. That's a whole other story. But essentially, I mean, the most powerful campaigns, like if you think about a brand like Spates, for example, what they do is they enmesh themselves in culture. So the brand idea behind Spates is to make Spates synonymous with mateship. So that's where, you know, all of that advertising, that's where it comes from, is how do we make this brand and the idea of being a good mate.
Right. So it's not about where do we literally put the billboards or what magazines do we go in. It's that bigger concept of how do we make this product really appealing.
Yes, and the most powerful way to do that is to enmesh it in culture, make it part of culture. So if you can convince people that the way to be sociable is to sit down and have an alcoholic drink with someone, that's ideal. Perfect.
Yeah.
So you know that, so that that really is, you know, so, and there are so many different, like, you know, there's mateship, there's sociability, there's, I mean, like, if you look at what the beer companies are doing now, like Heineken have got this whole thing about, you know, making beer something that sophisticated women drink. So there's a whole campaign, I don't know if you've seen it, where, you know, you've got girls and guys in a bar and one of them's ordered a cocktail and one's ordered a beer. Like, it's for someone like me, it's so easy to decode.
You can see the discussion in the boardroom. Wow, we've got to make beer cool for women. Why don't we have a waiter come up and they give them the wrong drinks and they have a laugh because the girl's having the Heineken. I know. And what about the resurgence of gin? I mean, gin's having its moment again, right? And I could see the meetings in the boardroom. Right, we've got to push gin. We've got to make it cool again. Let's talk about organics. Let's talk about botanicals. Let's do recipe books for gin drinks. Let's talk about people having gin clubs. And all of a sudden, it's happening here in Karori, Wellington.
Well, yes, and you know, we'll make it about being cool and sophisticated, and we'll focus on, you know, botanicals and the quality of the water and la la la. And it's like, you know, really? I mean, can most people really tell the difference between that gin and that gin? It's just 95% proof. Like,
I know, but it's working. And that's one of the things that's really annoying me at the moment is this push to make it healthy. And it is the kind of organic, low carb, you know, botanicals. There was one in the UK now, they're doing these seltzers. So it's like a water. Mm-hmm. They're trying to sort of almost sell it like a water, but it's alcohol, which is toxic, addictive, and carcinogenic.
Yeah.
It's a drug. No, it's
I had a, I was part of a, a, a sounds tragic, a course for, you know, menopausal women, like a nutrition thing. And the woman who ran that, who's very knowledgeable, she sent around this thing on a Friday afternoon about, you know, having a glass of wine because there was resveratrol in it. And I was furious. And I went back to her and I said, are you seriously recommending that menopausal women, who are the last group who should be drinking alcohol, that in order to get resveratrol, they should drink red wine? I said, that's completely irresponsible. I said, if you want resveratrol, eat blueberries. You know,
what have even a is what are you talking about? Resveratrol?
Resveratrol, which does exist in, it comes from red berries.
Oh.
It's an antioxidant. So
okay.
It is in red wine in small quantities. But if you were, it's not a reason to drink red wine. If you want resveratrol, eat blueberries. Like, you know, yeah. And I went back to him and I said, you are doing the job of the alcohol companies. You're positioning red wine as something that's healthy. And she was very, very defensive. And I had the same, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, I thought, be interested to know what her drinking habits were like, because she was not having a bar of it.
That was a conversation we were having before we were recording, but yes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, look, I'm going to wrap it up now, but I just want to say, so today, the day that we are recording is Friday, and you've told us that Fridays are difficult because for many decades, Friday night was the night to get drunk, and I can relate, and I'm sure most people watching this can. So what are you going to do tonight, Kate, to relax, soothe yourself, reward yourself for a hard week? What have you got planned?
Well, until recently, my recovery group was actually on a Friday night. So that was sort of like, yeah, now it's moved. Now it's on Thursday nights. So what normally happens on a Friday night is I try not do any work on a Friday afternoon. So I'll, you know, go for a walk, go to the library, sit around and read my book, do something relaxing. We either get takeaways, or my husband cooks pizza or something like that on a Friday night. We might go. So I live in Arrowtown. The Fork and Tap is the pub down the road. I can go to the Fork and Tap now and be completely fine. So we might go there. He'll have a beer. I'll have a kombucha, something like that. And then we come back and watch television.
Sounds wonderful.
Think about what we're going to do over the weekend.
And then you get to have that great hangover-free Saturday morning wake-up, which there's nothing else like it.
No.
Well,
and I don't...
Thank you.
Sorry.
You go. No, you go.
When I was saying about Friday, I don't fear Fridays anymore. Friday isn't a problem for me anymore, but it's more of a sort of a kind of nostalgic thing now. But, like, that's what I used to do, and I don't have to do that anymore. I don't have to worry about Friday nights and what I might do, and waking up on Saturday mornings feeling like the world has caved in.
Yeah, nice. And I like that you've reclaimed the pub too, because, you know, why can't we go to a public place with the person we love and have a relaxing drink? And it doesn't really matter what's in the glass. It's all that other stuff around us that is actually what's good.
Completely.
Okay, well, look, thank you. Bless you. Great that you're sober. Great that you came on here and chatted to us. Really appreciate it, Kate. And I'll put a link in the blog post around where I embed this video. I'll put a link, if you don't mind, to your Medium page and maybe your Instagram as well, if you're okay with that.
Sure. Yep.
Awesome. All right. And maybe also that book that you mentioned, No Bad Parts. I'll put a link to that as well in case anyone wants to look it up.
Yep. All right. Thank you so much,
Lisa.
Have a great weekend.
Bye.
Bye.